You're listening to Object of Sound from Sonos, the show where we bring you in tune with the music that shapes our culture. When music lives in the air, it's one thing, but when you know the undercurrents and the ideas that went into a song, and when you can feel its weight, it becomes more meaningful. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, a poet and culture critic, and I'll be your guide as we seek a deeper way of listening. So I recently called this toll-free phone line. The number was 1-833-34-BALDWIN. The first time I called in, I got asked if I wanted to hear a testimony. The second time, I got asked if I wanted to hear a meditation inspired by James Baldwin himself.
To go backwards in time, press star. To go forward, press the pound sign.
I was really struck by the warmth and comfort that I felt. It felt communal, that even over the phone, it seemed like I was being ushered into a church. The phone line is actually a part of a multimedia project called Chapter and Verse, The Gospel of James Baldwin. Originally, it was designed as a live musical performance, and in the pandemic, the phone line was made for anyone to call in and hear music and readings inspired by the work of James Baldwin.
One ought to rejoice in the fact of death. Decide to earn one's death. By confronting with passion the conundrum of life.
It is described as a 21st century ritual toolkit for justice, and it was created by the musician Michel Ndegio Cello. Michel is a vocalist, bassist, and songwriter whose career spans nearly 30 years. Her debut album, Plantation Lullabies, came out in 93 and is considered to be one of the seeds of the neo-soul movement that began to flourish in the mid to late 90s and still carries on today. James Baldwin is a writer who is easily archivable and also easy to dig up and represent and reframe because so much of his work still feels pressing and still feels like it's speaking to the America that we are living in. Even his statements that are nearly 50 years old can feel timely and can feel like they are in concert with America's reckoning. So Baldwin's influence spans generations, and Michel Ndegio Cello's influence also spans generations. And at the intersection is Chapter and Verse, which is a really thoughtful project that asks people to not only consume the work, but to take the work they're consuming and put it back into the world and seek out Baldwin and Baldwin's legacy. So this week on the show, I'm going to talk with Michelle about this project and how Baldwin has changed her worldview as a musician. Then I'll guide you through a playlist of songs that are inspired by or do retellings of literature. And you'll hear songs from Jamila Woods to Regina Spektor. You can hear that playlist over on Mixcloud at mixcloud.com/Sonos, and we'll leave a link to the playlist in the show notes. And then to close the show, I'll offer a final thought on the joys of discovery in any era. Michelle, it's so great to meet you. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's such a pleasure to meet you. I'm trying not to fan out. Your writing gets me through many a train ride, and I'm just very grateful for your thoughtfulness.
Oh, that is immensely kind. I mean, it's mutual. You know, I've been a big fan of yours for now, you know, decades. It's just a real pleasure to get to kind of talk with you about this project, which is brilliant and expansive. And I'm interested in starting at the beginning. Like, why did you take on the project? And was there any point where you were taking it on where you're kind of like, I've maybe taken on too much?
It started out as work. I was commissioned by the Harlem Stage to participate in their, they always do a whole month on Baldwin and they choose different artists. So that's how it came about. Because I must admit, I'm ashamed to say Baldwin came very late in my life. So the last 3 years I've been submerging myself in his work. So when the Harlem Stage brought me on, I chose The Fire Next Time. From 2015 till now, I literally have a copy of that book with me everywhere I go. It was a wake-up call for me, I guess. It gave me a language for something I hadn't really been prepared to deal with in terms of how systematic racism has affected my upbringing and my parents.
I appreciate your admission of being late to Baldwin, although I think that like being late to our ancestors is almost impossible. You know, if like we catch up to them while we're living, then that is the miracle, because I think so many of us are, one, you know, like the history of our ancestors is vast and there's just so much of it that we can't catch up to all of it. So I'm glad you caught up to Baldwin at all. And I'm glad you caught up on that book, which is, I feel like, not the entry point of Baldwin for most people. Where did you go after that? Like, what was the next step?
Oh, Another Country was the next step. It's Another Country and The Fire Next Time really hit home because the characters that are very similar. Like, I had a very strict Christian upbringing, totally relate to Rufus in Another Country in the sense of trying to figure out myself amidst situations that have to do with not only my livelihood, but my safety and my sanity. So those were the first two pieces of work that it really blew my mind. And then the essays of Freaks and Manhood that I studied for a while. And also The Devil Finds Work was mind-blowing as I began my journey into TV and film scoring. I lived with that one for at least a year.
That is my one. The Devil Finds Work is that's my favorite one.
Mind-blowing.
I would love to hear if anything revelatory came to you through this work, you know, working this closely with the language of Baldwin and your own abilities.
The most important aspect of The Fire Next Time for me is when he talks about the people in the stairwell or the people in the church or those who were just, you know, how many educated janitors did he know? I must admit that that's where I relate. I am autodidactic myself. I am an uneducated person. So it was clear to me when it went into the work, I had to get a lot of people to aid me. The director of the work, Charlotte Braithwaite, fantastic, is educated at Yale, teaches at MIT. So I had that energy to help me sculpt my ideas into a form that could hopefully resonate with others. And there's an amazing sound designer and songwriter named Justin Hicks. And he, to me, through our conversations, would aid me lyrically in bringing it into a metaphorical focus. I'm just trying to create a space where perhaps that energetic frequency could bring you into his work through song. And to create a church service, that's the thing to bring everyone to it. The first time we performed it was 2016 after the election of the Cheeto. And it was a cathartic experience. It allowed people to have sort of this real church sort of town hall experience through the work.
I'm glad you went there because I wanted to talk about church and the kind of, it's just such a, the project feels so communal. It was interesting for me to come across it in full at the time I did, because it does feel so warm and communal in a time where, of course, I cannot commune with anyone, you know? You know, that's like in a way, a real compliment to the work, because I felt full. I felt walking away from it like I was in community with folks. How did you cultivate that? I mean, is that just like from growing up and knowing how the church can move in folks?
As Baldwin says, I try to get away from the church, but I just can't. I mean, church and music to me are the only time I believe there are a group of people and we're all having one focus, trying to have a singular experience of transcendence. So I think that's always been my work. And I grew up in it playing go-go music. Soul and funk music are all about the collective mechanism. If we're all playing our part, it works well. There's not a lot of room for individuality. It's that collectiveness that makes you want to dance. It's that focus that brings about the uplift. It's what allows, you know, Aretha Franklin, Sissy Houston to reach those great heights, is when the band is tight. And so I'm just a big fan of that approach to music. And I think it's a thread in my work. That's the best part of being a musician, is that we're all in this together.
I did not grow up in the church. I was raised Muslim, so I didn't grow up in the church, but I grew up around the church. You know, I had elders and a church was in my community. And it seems like the thing that just draws me in is the aesthetics of the church, or like the sonic temple, so to speak. And I was always so amazed by the sound one choir of people could make, as if they're, you know, one voice. And there was something about the choir, in thinking about this past summer and this past year of global action and support for Black liberation, and how sometimes, at least for me, it was both uplifting to see how effectively the choir of people could work together, and sometimes demoralizing to see how quickly, you know, the things could fall apart. I've been thinking so much about the way that the pandemic and the way that racism are talked about in America, where it overlaps with this, like, well, when this is over, things will be fine, but no one's considering the difficulties that rest after the quote-unquote over. You know, there's something I've been thinking about with this project and with your work in general, is that, you know, so often Black writers and Black thinkers and Black revolutionaries get kind of cherry-picked, right? Their quotes get cherry-picked, or their lives get cherry-picked, or we don't see the fullness of them, right? And among the great many other things about this project that I loved, it really, like, is immersive. And it's a full offering. And I'm wondering, are you ever concerned in your own work that you will not be seen fully? And how did that concern bleed into the creation of this project?
Yes, I am not seen fully. And it's funny you say that question. I mean, we're going really fast. We're talking about a lot of things. I would like to settle there for a second, if that's all right.
Of course.
Someone had sent me The Battleground between James Baldwin and Norman Mailer. It was an article that was in Esquire. And basically, he talks about, there's a moment when your personality or your celebrity or how you proceed becomes larger than the work, and you stop working. You just become this voice that everyone's comfortable with you being. And that's kind of where I am now. And I'm finding myself getting back to the work. And when I get back to the work, I no longer have any interest in anyone's opinion. I'm no longer interested in the zeitgeist. I'm no longer interested in, you know, social critique. I find myself just really trying to make an attempt to see who I am next. I'm 52 years old, and the fame that I did acquire, or the laurels that people feel I should lean on, or the so-called name I've made for myself, is one that doesn't really resonate right now to me. And I am, like I said, just trying to figure out, what are we saying? When this over that they speak about, when will that be? It's not like the Band-Aid's been ripped off. We're still in the very first stage of the reckoning to the truth of what's happening in society. I just did something at Bard with Charlotte Braithwaite. It's called The Future is Present. And one of the interactions with students, one of the students affected me in a way, because they were like, I just don't have any desire for power. She was like, what is this power you speak of? What if that is not your goal? And we had to create this new language, you know, or new different discussion groups, you know. And so, like I said, I find myself trying to get back to my craft, which I'm realizing my craft is not, I'm not just a musician. I'm someone's mother and partner. Perhaps my craft is to listen. I'm trying to figure out how I can be a deeper listener and to take the platforms that I do have and use them not for a popularity contest, but just to find more information to share with others.
How do you feel like you've allowed yourself constant permission to evolve, just not musically, but also socially, politically, interpersonally? Because of course your work has, and I think your vision for the work has, from my point of view, but I'm also so impressed by, you know, you've always been so thoughtful. And I feel like a lot of folks I know who like begin a life or a quote unquote career very thoughtful sometimes run up against the wall of offering themselves permission to change those thoughts and evolve those thoughts beyond where they're at. I don't know if that's been a challenge for you, but if it hasn't, I'd love to be enlightened because I imagine it'll be a challenge for me one day.
Yes. It's because Hanif, I mean, not to use AA terminology, but I've hit the emotional bottom. I've hit the success bottom. Like, I have a fascination with people who've been humiliated. I feel like humiliation is like a great elixir. It can really change your inside of your being. And because I've, you know, lied, cheated, and lost important things and done wrong, it is only now that I am trying my best to be so good, because I tried the other way. And so that's where I am. I mean, I guess I'm like, I've been lucky to meet a couple of my heroes and who have held on to that self that made them. And it's not pretty. And so I'm not a dinosaur. I can see the comet coming, and I can look at my elders and people that have come before me and see fame and money come and go, you know? And so I'm trying to cultivate that part of myself that can be resilient and die gracefully. You know, Baldwin, Leonard Cohen, and David Bowie inspired me to how to hopefully die better, you know, to engage with the ending of your virility, your viability, your body, your mind. I mean, you're a writer. You are constantly engaged with yourself and trying to find the right words so that you can be known, you know. And so I must imagine you do that with yourself as well, to know yourself deeper.
I do. Probably too much at this point. I maybe know myself too well at this point.
Oh, but you will change. You will change, young man.
I hope so. You know, when I talked to someone about Chapter and Verse a couple weeks ago, I referred to it as an act of service almost because of how it leads people to the work. You know, it is work that leads people to work. And as much as I love some radical teachings, there are some that, of course, don't age well because they can't. It's impossible for them to. And so I'm wondering what you believe Baldwin could kind of set upon the landscape and teach today.
Oh, I think his message of love is this radical message of love and taking off the mask you fear you can't live without and know you can't live within. That one's still holding up. Also, that it's ugly. It's not pretty. This coming to truth is not a pretty thing. It's like catching the Holy Ghost at church. It's, you know, it's cathartic. It's ancient and pagan. What he could teach us now is just not to live in your shame, and also don't be beguiled. There's a system at play that has not grown old for no other reason but that you are Black. I would rather ask the question, I think Hanif is, wow, what would he have thought of Isabel Wilkerson? What would he have thought of Serpent with Feet? You know, I'm more interested. What would he dig now? What would he find here to be interested in? I think he'd be happy with how he's affected people's lives.
Yeah, I think sometimes when people talk about the musicality and the work of, or the way a Black writer speaks, or I'll say this when like non-Black people say it, I'm always like, what do you actually mean? You know what I mean? But I feel like when Black folks say it, I'm always like, well, I get it. And I get that, you know, and James Baldwin, he did have kind of, the presence of a soul singer, and not necessarily in decoration, but in the presentation of language and the delivery of language too, and in understanding like pace.
Oh, definitely. And I think in the writing, use making sermons where you have to have that arc and hit a point and bring people to this feeling is pretty much the same. I think pimps, preachers, poets, they all kind of are cut from the same cloth. They're trying to get you to a place, you know? And I think he'd have that. I was apprehensive about this experience with you because I must admit when the Baldwin Hotline project was over, I took him off my altar and I took down everything and I was ready to forget him. And now that I took the last few days to revisit the work, I'm just like, wow, this person really moved me in so many ways. And most of all is his musicality. It's the fact that I can sit and read his work for hours. It's though it is intense in subject matter, it sings on the page. And it's loving to read his work.
Are there any other writers who have pulled you to the point of wanting to make a project as expansive and generous as Chapter and Verse?
That's, wow, another writer that's moved me. Yeah, I'm really influenced by writers, so that's an intense one. I'm really into a woman named Sheila Hetty.
Oh, I love Sheila Hetty. Yeah.
Yeah. She really inspires me to go that route. I just read Heavy, too, because I wanted to share with some young people. Are you familiar with that book?
I am. Yeah. KSA's book. Yeah.
Yes. And so he's been on my mind for a while. And I've always wanted to make like a music video to every essay in Joan Didion's The White Album. I envy writers. I don't know if you can tell, like I have complete utter envy. It's something I wish I could master.
Do you not think that in your own way though, you like, do you not consider yourself a writer?
Oh, no. A great writer can put the pictures in your mind. And I don't have that yet. You can tell a story and you can connect all these moments and make the reader travel in their mind. And I haven't achieved that yet, I don't think.
Oh, wow. That's such a, because I feel that when I hear your lyrics, but I know that we are often our harshest critics.
See, I'm a manipulator of air and sound waves. I definitely think I can make music that can touch you.
Yeah.
But if I just had word alone, I don't think I'd be very successful.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining me and talking about Baldwin, about music, about writing. This has been a real pleasure, and it's an absolute honor to get to spend some time with you.
The same. And again, I am so grateful for your work and your time and consideration. And you really make music come alive on the page, and I'm very grateful to you.
Thank you so much. And now for a final thought. I was really struck by what Michelle said about coming to Baldwin late. And a big part of this podcast is about discovery, and a big part of my lived everyday life is about discovery and stripping the shame away from not knowing and then knowing. And I think there's a lot of pleasure that I have found in coming to anything late, music, writing, art. When I first started getting into poems, it was 2011. And I was, you know, well beyond any schooling age. I didn't study poems in college. I didn't go to grad school. I was living in an apartment and working a job I didn't love. And I am in a city where there is a robust and brilliant poetry community. And so I went around and I asked poets here for book recommendations. And I took those book recommendations and I did this thing that I learned loving music as a kid, where I would read to the back of the books and read the acknowledgement pages and look at all the thank yous and see what poets the poet who wrote the book would thank. And then I would go and get those poets' books and I would read their thank yous and get those poets' books. And so what I was doing was building a lineage. You know, Michelle and I talked a bit about lineage and legacy, and what I found myself doing through the excitement of discovery, was kind of unintentionally chasing down my own poetic lineage before I even knew how to write a poem myself. And so I began with poets like Adrian Matika, like Khadija Queen, like Terrence Hayes. And I went back to poets like Lucille Clifton and Audre Lorde. And I went back to poets like Robert Hayden, like I. And through this, I was basking in the excitement of newness, in the excitement of not knowing something and then being suddenly confronted with a wave of knowing and the pleasure that knowing can bring. And so as we close out, my invitation this week is for you to find an album you love. Listen to that album and read its liner notes or read the thank yous or dig into a sample used on it. Let that information take you back to find something attached to the album you love that you maybe did not know existed before. Think about lineage. Think about inspiration. And think about the potential that something you love can make a path for you to something else you might love and just haven't discovered yet. This has been Object of Sound from Sonos. Thank you to our guests this week, Michelle and Deggy Ocello. To hear all the music and the full version of the show, listen on Sonos Radio or find us at mixcloud.com/Sonos. And while you're there, check out some of the other great shows on Sonos, including specials from Tiwa Savage, FKA Twigs, and Sun Ra Orchestra. Plus, a new episode of Unsung featuring Omar Apollo. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If you love the show, rate it and share it with your friends. And also, tell us what you like about the show. And I'd also love to hear what you're listening to. I believe music discovery is a communal thing, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you're listening to in an email. We're at objectofsound@sonos.com. Follow us on Instagram @SonosRadio. This show is produced by Work by Work, Scott Newman, Gemma Rose Brown, Babette Thomas, and by me, Hanif Abdurraqib. The show is mixed by Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Extra gratitude to Joe Dawson and Saida Blount at Sonos. I'm always talking about music online on Instagram and Twitter @Neef Muhammad. Thank you for listening.